God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anyone here tonight in your first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you. Anybody here? Hi, Leslie. You're able to unmute yourself if you would like to say hello. Anybody first 30 days? All righty then. The preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous says that Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. So the format of this meeting is an open speaker ask it basket. Tonight, we are very excited to welcome Brian Kay from Hamilton, Ontario, to tell his story. And after he tells his story, somewhere around the top of the hour, we'll take a short break, allow him to take a break, and then we'll call for a few announcements, path the seventh tradition basket, etc. And then we'll reconvene, and the last half an hour, we'll ask Brian some questions. So please feel free to send a question through the chat to the user questions. So very excited to have Brian. He came and spoke at our Monday night home group, and he's got a great message, and I don't want to take up another minute of his time. Brian, thank you for coming to share tonight.
Hey, David, thank you. Thanks for having me. I was hoping to go a little longer. Maybe these hiccups would clear up, but it looks like it's not to be. I apologize in advance as if it's annoying. About a half an hour ago, I got hiccups and they haven't gone yet. So please forgive me. maybe it'll be memorable for that reason. If nothing I say connects with anybody, you can have a laugh over my plight. As David said, I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Prince George Group in Hamilton, Ontario, up in Canada. And I am an alcoholic. As a result of God, this program, all of you, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink of alcohol since January 19th, 2007. It was separated from alcohol by God at that time. Although I didn't quite believe it until a little while later that was the last time. It took a little while for that to sort of sink in for me to kind of accept that, okay, I think something's actually changed for me. And as a result of really just following the directions of my sponsor, I didn't really know what was going on. I didn't really understand it. I don't think I even really believed it, to be honest with you. I just had the barest amount of faith based on hanging around with him and his friends in the program, going to meetings, and then following his directions. And as a result, and I'll share that a little bit later with you, you know, sort of what happened to me. To get to that point, I'll start back a little bit. Some of my jokes don't work for the audience down in the States. I come from a part of Canada where drinking and alcoholism is sort of, you know, people think that, oh, that's just what happens down there. I'm from the East Coast of Canada, and we have a reputation with the rest of the country as being big drinkers. And certainly that was my experience as a kid. There wasn't a lot to do where I grew up. So we spent, you know, around ages, around 14, I started to drink, and it was more of a curiosity between my friends and I. We were like, what's this drinking thing all about? Everybody seems to really be into it and really want to do it. So let's find out what it's all about. And so we did. I mean, we were, you know, four 14 and 15 year old kids. We got four cases of beer, which is 24 2-4s for four 14 and 15 year olds, not knowing what we were doing. You know, we called the cab company. The oldest looking of us, my buddy, stuffed his shoes to make himself look a little taller. And he met the cabbie, and he tried to talk in this dark, or this deep voice to convince the guy that it was okay for him to buy this beer. And the cabbie couldn't have cared less, right? He just handed the cases and took the money and left. And I proceeded to have the best night of my life to that date, to that point, at 14. I think I got through six beers. Like I, excuse me, but something happened to me that night when that I had this experience of just feeling so happy and so peaceful and so at ease and having so much fun and just being so relaxed for that time. And I thought, man, I'm going to do this again. Like I'm going to do this as much as I can because I really, really enjoyed it, you know? So I did, you know, I mean, at 14, it was sort of hard for me to put that together. But by the time I was 15, I had a job and I was, you know, drinking just about every weekend. I'd found friends who liked to do that, who liked to party, who had, you know, had a buddy whose mom had left to work out west for about 6 months. And so that was just party central. And that's what my life became about, was just drinking and partying and having that experience, experiencing that, that release, that joy, that feeling of, I don't know, almost impervious, right? Like bulletproof. We used to say drink till you're bulletproof. And that's what it felt like, you know, for the first, I don't know, probably 8-10 years of my drinking career, it was very much like that. Like I just had a good time. I had a party. I felt that I could connect with people, which is something that I really had a hard time doing when I was sober. I was more shy, more nervous. And so alcohol sort of provided that social lubricant, you know, to be able to show up and have some fun, make some friends, sort of get a reputation, be able to talk to the girls, like that kind of stuff. And like I said, that went on for probably 8-10 years until my early 20s, when it started to change a little bit. It started to become a little bit more of a necessity. When I was, you know, I'd be feeling down. I'd, you know, have these periods of like feeling like, oh, I don't really fit in here. I was away at university and I felt very lonely. And so alcohol kind of started to become my cure for that too. I was still having the party and still having the fun, but then there were times where I was like, I'm just not feeling very good. And so I would, you know, turn to the drink at those times too. When I was 24, I lost my dad to suicide. And at that point, my drinking, as the book says, assumed more serious proportions. And I hardly drew a sober breath for months after that event. And for it was years I drank over that, because I had no way to deal with the feelings from that. You know, I just had no. So anytime I was reminded, anytime that that pain, this is what it looked like to me. I've since learned more about alcoholism to understand a little bit more about the disease. But from my perspective, it was just like, it was so painful to be in my head that drinking was like the only thing that gave me that release to get away from that. And it wasn't, I wasn't having as much fun. I wasn't having the party. I wasn't having the good times as much anymore. More, I was sort of seeking, you know, lower companions, finding the hole in the wall bar to drink at, the just oblivion seeking, you know, like just really having a hard time. Through that, I picked up a hostage in the form of my wife, and we had a couple of kids, and it just got worse and worse. And we tried some geographical cures, you know. We thought, oh, we lived on the East Coast, well, that must be the problem, let's move to the West Coast. And you know, you get out to the West Coast and it's good for a little while, and then sort of set up shop again, you know, sort of find the friends, find the drinking holes, and then it starts to look a lot like it looked before. And then, you know, but then we have the brilliant plan, well, the problem is we're on the West Coast, we should move back towards the East. And you know, so we did that sometimes, and we'd sort of have that experience of a period of peace, the period of reconstruction, and then inevitably I would sort of pull it all down on our heads again, not knowing that that's what I was doing. Like from my perspective, it just looked like, you know, oh, things are good now, this is great, this was a great decision. And then slowly it would sort of come back to that place of like, oh man, you know, I'm not really getting along with people, work, I don't really like work, I'm struggling in my relationship with my wife, I don't really know what to do with my kids, I don't know how to make money. Like it would start to look like a mess again, but it always looked external. You know, these are problems in my life. These are problems with the people in my life, not an internal issue. I never saw that until later. You know, so we kept doing those geographicals, and it kind of got pretty bad, you know, towards the end of my drinking. So we're at like almost 20 years in, and we've been sort of just slogging along, having more kids. I have four total, and just, you know, moving jobs, moving houses, moving friendships, moving, like, trying everything to just feel better, to just feel some kind of peace, to find out, like, I started to become aware that, like, there's something wrong with me, but I don't really know what it is. Like, I can't really figure it out. And I'm, you know, I read some self-help books or, like, go to a seminar and maybe get a little bit of peace and feel like, oh, this is great. I'm just going to, you know, sit and meditate under this tree every day. And that's going to fix all my problems. And that would last about 2 days, you know, and then it would just be me again. And I'd have those feelings again, that kind of emptiness, that confusion about my life and not really being able to put it together. I remember looking at my neighbor, like, this is almost at the very end. I'm like watching my neighbor and he's like, he's got a job. He goes to work every day. His wife likes him. His kids seem happy to see him. And I'm just watching him thinking, how the hell do you do that? I can't figure that out. You know, I can't make sense of how you live your life that way. It just doesn't seem to be like that. A little while after that, I ended up running into somebody from Alcoholics Anonymous, and they gave me, they were really happy to meet me. I overheard them talking to somebody else about being sober, and I was like, you know, it sort of piqued my interest. And so I said, I found him later, and I said, oh, I heard you saying you were 5 years sober. And I'm just looking for info, right? Like, I don't want to set anything in motion. I'm just kind of, you know, tell me about that. And he tricked me because he was like, why are you asking me that? And I was like, I wasn't ready for that, you know? So out of my mouth comes, well, maybe I drink too much. And so his eyes light up and he's like, oh, really? Let's have a talk, you know? And he's got like a big book on a spring-loaded mechanism that just like pops out and he's just ready to go, you know? And so he sits me down and we have this talk about him. He tells me about him. He tells me his experience. He tells me how, you know, everything was great, having a good time. And then at the end of his story, he's like leaving the town he lives in like a stolen truck, and everything he owns is in a garbage bag on the front seat beside him. And it's just end of the line, you know, and then he finds AA and he gets sober and he tells me a little bit about the steps and how they work, and enough for me to go, huh, that kind of makes sense. You know, that starts to make sense to me. I start to see a little bit of the way I've been sort of building it up and then tearing it down and then building it up and tearing it down. And I never really saw that before. Like, it never occurred to me that that was something that maybe I was doing, you know, that maybe I was the one who was, you know, having this reconstruction period. And then I would tear it down through, you know, the series of sprees, through the massive irresponsibility. Like, work doesn't like it when you just don't show up. My wife doesn't like it when I go to the corner store to get gas and call her 2 days later from 1,500 miles away, or like, well, less than that, 1,500 kilometers away. And she's like, where are you? And I'm like, oh, I just drove, you know, to another province for no reason. Like, I just, you know, I'm crazy. Like, I can't put it together. So I started to see a little bit of that, you know, for the first time. So I thought, okay, well, maybe I'll go to AA, which is what his suggestion was. He didn't live around me. I was away at that time. And when I ran into him, and so when I got back home, I sort of hummed and hawed about it though. You know, I'm kind of like, why am I an alcoholic? I'm not sure. Maybe I am. Maybe I'm not. And then my wife, in her infinite wisdom, says, well, just go. And if you're not, don't go back. You know, I can't put that together in my head, but it's very plain to her. That's why in the chapter to the wives, the progression of alcoholism is described in four paragraphs. I need 45 pages, the doctor's opinion, plus, you know, like the story, like I can't put it together from all that information. And to the wives, it's like, is he this or this? And it's like, oh yeah, okay. So to her, it makes total sense, right? She's just like, just go and see what happens. And I go, and it was wonderful. It was an amazing experience. I'd never felt so at home anywhere that I could remember walking into that AA meeting. It was like people who shared my sense of humor, had some of the same experiences, talked the same kind of way. Like, it was wonderful. You know, I felt so relieved to finally have a little bit of clarity to be like, this is what's wrong with me. This is why I'm struggling so much. This is why I can't figure anything out. This is why it's because I'm an alcoholic. And you know, you tend to, I did anyway, I started to like put a lot of labels on myself, you know, about that, like I'm somehow immoral, or I'm unworthy, or I'm weak, I'm stupid. I'm like, you know, I start to come up with these explanations because everybody around me, and this is the experience of most people with drinking who aren't alcoholics. They're like, you know, it says it in the big book, like, why can't he take it or leave it alone? You know, well, she's such a wonderful girl. You think he would quit for her? Like those kinds of statements, I would say at large is sort of the opinion of most people. It's like, well, why couldn't you do that? If you cared, why wouldn't you just do that? And I also thought that, you know, I thought, well, I must not though, or maybe there's something like just completely broken inside of me that I can't do that. And, or maybe I'm just, you know, I'm evil or something like that. And I think that because I don't really have another explanation for it. And then I show up to AA and they're like, no, you're an alcoholic. That's the problem. I'm like, oh my God, I wow. And so I was elated, you know, I'm like, I'm so excited because I have an explanation and there's a group of people who are kind of like me. And there seems to be this kind of program around. I don't really know anything about it at that point. And so I'm really, really excited, you know? So I go home and I'm like saying, oh, I'm an alcoholic. And she's going, yeah, duh. Like she knew, that's what happened. And then here's the next, what happened. So that lasted about 8 months. And then I got drunk again, eight and a half months. I got loaded again. I went to the store, I got a case of beer. I was sitting in my office and, you know, I don't know, halfway through it or third of the way through it. My wife opens the door and her eyes get as big as saucers. And she says, what happened? And I said, the most honest words ever. I don't know. I don't know. And I didn't know what had happened. I hadn't been to the meetings for a couple of weeks. I'd actually really fallen ill, and not just like the fake kind of ill where, you know, you could go, but I was like bedridden sick. And then I was like the kind of half and half, and then I was the, yeah, I definitely should have gone back and didn't. And so I went back, you know, after that. I'm like, then I'm saying, well, I'm not going to tell them, you know, I'll go back, but I'm not going to tell them that I drank. I don't want to ruin it for them, you know, like, so I go back to the meeting, and then of course the first person I talk to, I'm like blubbering, like, oh, I drank. And they're, but they loved on me, you know, they were a great group of people. They loved me. Like, they were like, it's okay, you're an alcoholic. It would be surprising if you didn't drink, you know, start coming back to the meetings. You get more involved, you know, maybe get a sponsor. Like, you don't have a sponsor, so maybe get yourself a sponsor. And oh, okay. You know, so I started doing that again. And I went to the meetings. I went to more meetings and I talked to different people, and I did get a sponsor. And then I got drunk again. And then I went back to the meeting, and it was the same kind of stuff. Like, they loved on me. Oh, it's okay, you're an alcoholic, and maybe you need to do this, and maybe you need to do that. And I'd say, okay, I'll do that. And so for the next couple of years, every couple of weeks, I'd go and get drunk again. And every time I would go back to the meeting, I would get the same kind of response from the people there. They, you know, they loved on me. They didn't know really what was going on with me. They would just, you know, maybe get to more meetings. And so by the end of that time, I had, you know, I was chairing meetings, setting up meetings, tearing down meetings, making coffee. I think I'd spoken. I have no idea what the hell I told those people. I had a sponsor, and we were buddies. Like, he was my buddy, and we would get together and drink coffee and talk, and nothing changed, you know, nothing changed over those couple of years. And sort of towards the end, like right before I had my last, what was to be my last drink, I had an experience which was very similar to my, you know, sitting on my front lawn in the morning, watching my neighbor trying to figure out, how are you doing this? I'm at a meeting that it's the group celebration. There's a, you know, 150, 200 people in this room. There are, you know, all the folding tables are out and they're just piled high with food and like egg salad sandwiches and deviled eggs for years. And I'm leaning against the wall by myself with like my sad little styrofoam cup, half full of coffee, looking at everybody saying, feeling exactly the same thing. Like, why, what's wrong with me? Why can't I get this thing? Like, why can't I get sober? You know, why are you sober and I can't get sober? I couldn't understand it. I went on a business trip a little while after that, and again got, you know, got drunk, but it was different. It was a different drunk this time, and I'm glad for it now. The difference was I had no thought about the drink before I took it. So most of the time in those couple of years, I sort of had the fight, you know, the internal dialogue, like, oh, I shouldn't do this. It's bad. You shouldn't drink. You're not supposed to drink. It's no good to drink. You know, I'd heard all these speakers and all the talk to all these different people, and like pretty clearly drinking's bad, shouldn't be drinking. And so I'd have this kind of fight, you know, inside of myself where I would try not to do it. And, you know, sometimes I would like not do it that night, but then the next night I'd get hammered, or I'd put it off for a couple of days, or I thought that was important. You know, it seemed that it was important that I struggle, because I thought I was going to figure out how to win, right? Like I was going to figure out the trick. I was going to figure out the thing to say, the thing to think about, the thing to, the little trick, you know, like the think the drink through to the end. Like somebody told me that. And one night that worked, you know? So I thought, oh man, maybe this is the trick, you know? That's what I really thought was going to be the case. But that last drunk was me. I was away on a business trip. And I was eating in the same place we'd been eating the whole time. And I saw a pint on the bar with an orange wedge on the edge of the pint glass. And I thought, man, that looks so good. And so I ordered one, and then I drank that. And then I ordered another one, and I drank that. And then I ordered another one, and I started to drink that, when all of a sudden it occurred to me that I wasn't drinking. That was the first moment at which it occurred to me that I was not drinking. Two and a half drinks in. And at that point I thought, well, I'm going to finish the night. There was no doubt about that. And I did. But when I woke up the next morning, I had a very different thought, and it was one that I had never had before. And the thought was, I don't want to drink anymore. I don't think I'm going to be able to stop. And I had never put those two things together before. I always thought, I don't want to drink anymore, and I'm going to figure out how to stop. And at that moment, I realized, I think I lost my self-reliance. You know, that was a term I learned later. But I believe in that moment, I lost my self-reliance. And so I came back home to Hamilton, and I was terrified, because I thought, like I said, I thought the fight was important, right? So if there's no fight, then there's no hope. There's no chance for me. If I could just be walking down the street and all of a sudden find myself drinking, that I was a goner. Like I didn't have anything for that. My intellect wasn't going to solve that. And so I called my sponsor, same guy, same buddy, you know, we hadn't really done a lot except hang out. And he actually said something different to me too. He said, what we're doing is not really working for you. Why don't you go to some different meetings and find some different people to talk to? He didn't fire me, but he just said, you know, seek out a different experience. And I did. And a couple of weeks roaming around, going to meetings every night, I was scared to death. Like I was scared to death that I was just going to get drunk at the drop of a hat, you know? So I wandered into a big book workshop one night, and the guy at the front of the room was talking about step one out of the big book. And he explained my life to that point through that book, not knowing who I was, no idea I was in the room. He was just doing his thing, talking about step one. And he explained everything that had been happening to me to that point, especially in the last 3 years. I went up to him and I said, what are you talking about? And he said, it's the big book. And I thought, I read that, you know, and I didn't get any of that. I thought, man, these people are really messed up. If I ever get that bad, then I'll maybe try to get some help. But I didn't connect with it, you know, when I just read it myself, because I read it like a novel, right? It's like a Tom Clancy novel. I'm just flipping the pages. Oh, I wonder what's going to happen with carpet slippers guy. But I had no real connection to the information. And it wasn't until, I asked him if he would help me, and he said, yes, but are you willing to go to any lengths? And I said, yes, I am. I lied because I had no idea what he was talking about, but I wanted help. So I said, yes. Then he said, well, we're going to do what was done with me, which means you're going to come to my house a couple times a week. We're going to read the book. And when it says to do something, you're going to do it. And I thought, okay, I could do that. And that's what I did. You know, I showed up at his house, usually twice a week. We would read the book, and he taught me a different way to read it. He said, you're not going to read it like a novel. You're going to read it like a textbook. And the way you're going to do that is, when it makes a statement, you're going to turn it into a question, and you're going to ask yourself if that's true for you. Don't just accept it at face value. discover whether or not this is true. Is this you? Did you drink like this? Did you feel like this? Did this happen to you? Is this your experience? And so I read the book that way. And I had to concede that it was very much my experience, probably 90%. You know, not every line in the book is me. I didn't go to every, I never signed a temperance pledge. But, you know, a lot of it I had done, a lot of it I'd felt was my experience. And he said that I had to understand what it meant to be an alcoholic. The reason I thought I was an alcoholic was because I went to meetings where people who I thought were like me said they were alcoholics. So therefore, I must be an alcoholic too. But I didn't know what it meant to be an alcoholic until I went through those, the doctor's opinion and the first 45 pages of the book. Then I understood what it meant to be an alcoholic. And it actually wasn't anything like I thought it was, you know, like I had that idea, you know, probably from movies or childhood stories of like the guy under the bridge, the guy on the park bench, and there's always a paper bag with a bottle in it and a, you know, a dirty old raincoat or something, you know, lying in a gutter. Like it's not a guy who has a job, who has kids, who has a wife, who has a car, who lives at a house. Like I didn't think that I could be an alcoholic because it looked to me like my life was, you know, relatively intact. And I wasn't sleeping under benches or bridges or anything like that. So he, through the book and through conversations with him, I came to understand that that had nothing to do with alcoholism. It was 100% about what happened to me when I drank and what happened to me when I wasn't drinking. That was it. Like nothing else mattered. You know, it didn't matter if I'd gone to jail or if I'd gone bankrupt or if I'd had a drunk driving charge or if I'd, you know, it didn't matter if any of that stuff had happened to me because none of that was whether had anything to do with whether or not I was an alcoholic. And so I had to understand that I had an obsession, which was going to make sure that I always drank again, you know, and I had an allergy that made sure that when I took a drink, I was not going to be able to stop drinking. I was just going to keep on drinking. And he told me, you know, read the book, compare it to your experience. Like when you read about the allergy, when this abnormal reaction to alcohol, do you have any ability to control your drinking once you start, you know, and discounting that one night back in 92 when I had such a great night and I had the, you know, three or four beer and stayed in that wonderful buzz and I met her and it was a great night, you know, discounting that one exceptional evening, what happens to me once I take a drink? And I had to concede that my experience was that I always continued to drink until later, and it didn't really have anything to do with what I thought was going to happen. So if I made a plan, it didn't matter. If I was supposed to be somewhere, it didn't matter. If I wasn't supposed to spend up the rent money, it didn't matter. Once I started to drink, it looked a lot to me like I was just changing my mind about what was going to happen, right? Like I thought I was going to just stop in for one, and then I decided to have another one, and then I decided to have another one. But in reality, I wasn't making any decisions about that at all. I was in the grips of an allergy. I was in the grips of an abnormal reaction to alcohol, which would ensure that I continued to drink. And I had to concede that that was the case. And the second part around the obsession, that when sober, do I make the most insane decision of my life, which is to pick up a drink again? And I had to concede that too. And I did not like to concede that one because I really had a lot of faith in my intellect and my ability to, you know, I really believe that I was capable of making a decision like that. And that if I had sufficient reason or sufficient desire or sufficient circumstances that I would be able to stop. But what I learned from the book is that that's simply not the case for alcoholics. There is no sufficient reason. There is no sufficient circumstance, which will somehow enable me, you know, to kind of rouse myself out of the lethargy, as it says, that was never going to happen. And I didn't like that very much, but I had to concede that I believed it was true. And he said, that's all that matters when we're talking about alcohol. Doesn't matter how much or how long or what or any of that kind of stuff. It's just all about what happens when you drink it and what happens in between drinks. The other part, of course, the unmanageability, you know, is a big part of what happens between drinks. And it became very clear to me in those 3 years when I looked at them through that lens, what had been happening to me was the unmanageability, which is so beautifully described on page 52. In the middle of the page, there's a paragraph. It's called the bedevilments. And it says, you know, prey to misery and depression. I'm full of fear. Can't seem to be a real help to other people. Like, that is a wonderful description of unmanageability. And so what would happen is I would have those feelings, you know, and so I'm like, okay, I'm not drinking anymore. And then all of a sudden, all the fear and anxiety and that feeling of uselessness would just like overwhelm me. And then I would just think, I can't stand to feel like this. I can't stand to be like this anymore. I can't be here anymore. You know, it'd be the thought that I had. I got to change a channel. And the only way I knew how to do that was to drink. If I drank, it changed the channel. If I drank, I got that sense of ease and comfort that came at once from taking a couple drinks. That was my experience. Even at the end, when things were so bad and it really stopped working, like the end of the nights were terrible. But at the beginning, I still got that sense of ease and comfort that came from those first couple of drinks, you know? And so it's like, I show up at AA, I have all this unmanageability, this emptiness, this hole inside of me. And I show up at AA and I'm like, okay, I'm not drinking anymore. I'm not going to use my only solution to living anymore. And I would stand it for as long as I could, you know, I would stand being sober as long as I could. And then I would get drunk and I would be drunk as long as I could be drunk. And then I would be sober for as long as I could be sober. And I just went around and around. And that was only going to get worse, you know? And so he pointed that out to me. Yeah. The other thing he pointed out to me is that I probably had always been like that. You know, if I think back to when I'm a little kid, the sense is like, I never felt like I fit in. I never felt like I belonged. I always felt different. You know, I always felt like other people had something going on that I wasn't part of. And that was the unmanageability. I didn't know that's what it was. And I didn't use words like feeling of uselessness or prey to misery and depression, but I did feel the disconnect, you know, I did feel the emptiness. And so the first drink I had when I had such a great time treated a problem that I was unaware of. I didn't know I had the problem until it wasn't there. And it was the way I knew it wasn't there is because all of a sudden I'm at ease and I'm having fun and I'm at the party and I'm with my friends and it's okay. Everything is okay. And that was my experience of alcohol because it treated the unmanageability. So, you know, fast forward all those years in AA, trying to go without the treatment to the unmanageability, and it just eats me alive every time. And so I got all that, you know, I got all that stuff through conversation, through examining my life, through reading the book, and I conceded that I was an alcoholic. I am an alcoholic. My life is unmanageable by me. And the bad news about step one is that it is a deadly disease. It's going to kill me. Like, it doesn't get better. You know, it's never going to go the other way. It's going to take me out. Like, I'm going to die. My liver's going to explode. My brain's going to burst. My heart's going to go. Or I'm going to end up in the wet brain, basically, like Karsarov syndrome. I don't remember the doctor's name, but, you know, basically in a permanent state of insanity because I've destroyed my body's ability to absorb vitamin B. So I'm going to be that, or I'll get locked up. Like, there's no good outcome here, you know? And I saw that, and I had a very clear moment. I was sitting in the afternoon, and I remember the day sitting with my book, doing this work, and thinking, I don't want to die. I don't want to die. You know, I had flirted with that. There were many nights where at the end of the night, like when it wasn't working anymore, where I'm, you know, in my basement trying to think of the least painful way in which to kill myself because I don't want to be here anymore. But in that final, you know, in that analysis, I don't want to die. And so I went back to my sponsor and I said, well, what do I have to do? You know, I am an alcoholic. What do I have to do? And that's actually a pretty good news. It's bad news. Don't get me wrong. Step one is not a feel good step. It should feel like shit. You should, when you finally see it, you should go, oh shit. Or, oh no. Or, you know, it's a desperate place to be. However, the best news of all is that if that is the position that you are in, we have a solution to that problem. We don't have a solution to other problems, but we have a solution to that problem. If you are an alcoholic, if you are powerless over alcohol, as described by the obsession and the allergy, and your life is unmanageable, we have a solution for that problem that has been, you know, written down by these guys who figured it out all these years ago and has been tried and worked on over all these years and was carried to me by this man who had that experience. So you don't need to figure anything else out. All you got to do is diagnose yourself as an alcoholic. Is it you? Is it true for you? And if that be the case, then all you have to do after that is follow the directions as they're laid out in the book. There is a program of action that is described for us to treat that condition. So if you've got the condition, fantastic, because we've got the solution for that condition. And so I went to him and what do I have to do? All the fights out of me now, you know, all the opinions are out of me now, all the ideas about how we could improve the book and improve the steps, they're all out of me now because I don't want to die. I do not want to die. And so he says, well, we're going to do step two. And okay, what do I have to do? He says, well, you need a power. You have a power. And I'm like, no, I don't. My power is my mind. It's my intellect, you know? And he says, well, that's not going to work because you need a power greater than yourself. Human power is not sufficient here. I thought, okay. And he said, well, you better go home and come up with a power and then come back. And I thought, okay, I'll go home and see what I can figure out. And I didn't really know, you know, so I'm sitting there, I'm thinking, oh, what kind of power? Oh, and the other thing, this guy's a minister, right? Now we don't talk about that, but I know that about him. So in addition to thinking I have to come up with a power, I'm thinking it's got to be a good one because he's going to have to buy it, right? So that's what I'm thinking about when I go home. And so here's what I came up with. Please steal it. If you are struggling in step two, if you think about this and you have a hard time and you look at all the God words, when you look at the steps and you see all the God words in the book and it holds you back and you can't figure it out, please steal this because it worked. I went home and this is what I came up with. There's something, I don't know what it is. I'm not going to think about it. I'm just going to do these steps and see what happens. That is a sufficient power in order to practice the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and experience a recovery. That is sufficient. You do not need to be able to describe it, write a book about it, convince anybody else about it. All you have to do is have something. We're not in the Jesus business or the Buddha business or any of that. That stuff's great. And if that's your power, fantastic. That is wonderful. Please use it. Please embrace it. But if you're not there and you can't figure that out, then you don't have to do that. It can be anything. It's power. Lack of power is the dilemma. It's not lack of prayer. It's not lack of God. It's not lack of information. It's lack of power. So in step two, when it says, you know, is there a power? Is there something? Are you now willing? Are you even willing to believe that there's a power greater than yourself? That's the question. And it says, if you can answer yes, you are on your way. And that was what I came up with. And I went back to him and I was prepared to argue this one out with him. And he said, do you have a power? And I said, yes. And he said, okay, let's do step three. He didn't care. He had experience with this program. He'd worked with tons of guys. It didn't matter that he was a minister. That was his belief. He didn't need me to believe what he believed. He just needed to know that I had a power so that we could move forward on the rest of these steps. And we talked about step three, talked about the different parts of step three, that there's four different parts of step three, not just one part. It's not just the, you know, the prayer or the step that's written in the book. The second beautiful description of unmanageability is found on pages 60 to 63, where it talks about the actor trying to direct the show, where it gives me the line that that I'm trying to wrest satisfaction and happiness from this world by trying to manage well, that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my problem. That's the information that, and it's so beautifully laid out for me that this is what it looks like trying to manage the unmanageable life. You know, it's like, I'm having a hard time managing my unmanageability. You know, I really can't get my head around it. And so I go over those pages with him and he says that you have to be convinced that this is the case. That's the first part of step three. And I was convinced. I was absolutely convinced. And the second part is I'm going to make a decision. And the decision is that God is the way we're going to go. God's the Father. He's the principal. You know, that he's going to be God and I'm going to be me. And it's not like this. You know, God is not my co-pilot. We're in the wrong seats, man, if God is my co-pilot. It's like this. It's a subjective position. God is in charge, and I am going to do my best to do his will. That's the idea. And, you know, I maybe don't like that too much, but I need to fire myself as the manager of my life based on my poor performance. And we used to joke and say a monkey could do a better job, make better decisions than I was able to make to that point, because he might be right at least half of the time, you know, and I was not batting anywhere near that. And so the idea is that maybe this power, whatever it is, you know, the book says God, but in my mind, I'm replacing it with, you know, what I've got, this thing. And that's fine, you know. So maybe this power could do a better job than I can do. We're just going to see what happens. And then there's a prayer. I say the prayer with my sponsor. We get down on our knees. We say the prayer. And then the last part of step three is that I launch into step four. I launch into vigorous action. If I am not sitting with a piece of paper writing names down, I have not completed step three. How do I know if I've completed step three? I've got a piece of paper and I'm writing names down for step four. To that point, all those years in and out of AA, I thought I was doing 1, 2, 3 out, 1, 2, 3. I heard that. It's funny, right? The 1, 2, 3 out waltz or the 1, 2, 3 out dance. And you kind of joke about it. And what step are you on? Oh, I was on step three, but I got drunk again. It's like, no, I wasn't on step three because I never sat down and wrote any inventory. Had I sat with inventory, then I'd been able to say that, yes, I had completed a step three. I had never completed step one. I didn't understand what it meant to be an alcoholic. How could I be completing a step three? I don't have any idea about, not that I don't have an idea about power. I don't need power because I'm not powerless if I don't understand step one. So I get to that point. He explains that. He sends me home to write inventory, which I do. I write inventory and I go back to him and I read all my inventory to him. We have a talk about it. You know, it was terrifying prospect, but the fight had gone out of me a little bit at that point too, because I'd argue with him and then he would say this every time. He'd let me run it out a little bit about my ideas, my grand ideas about everything. And then he would say, you can do whatever you want, but if you don't want to die an alcoholic death, you'd better do this. And I had no answer for that. Not one, you know, so I would go, okay. And then I would go and write or go and do whatever the hell he told me to do. And so when I got to the inventory point, it's like, I didn't really want to do it, but I also knew that I didn't have a choice. There wasn't another door, you know, there wasn't another, the shortcut step around. I'm just going to pass right straight to 12 or something like, so I did the inventory. I did the fifth step with him. He sent me home again to get down on my knees and ask God to remove these things from me because there was nothing I could do about them. You know, the things that came up in the inventory, the defects of character, you know, 6 and 7 isn't like, hey, work on your defects now. No, 6 and 7 is ask God, become willing, and then ask God to remove your defects because there's nothing you can do about them. You cannot do anything at all about them. And so if you've admitted they're objectionable, there's nothing you can do about it. Take it to God, ask him to remove those things from you. Ask him to remove the things from you that stand in the way of his usefulness for you and your fellows. That's a pretty strong caveat because there's a couple of ones that I got to keep, man, damn it. But that's the deal, right? They are of use. What's the use? Well, I run into people who have those defects of character, who struggle with those defects of character, who cause problems with those defects of character. We can have a conversation about that. We can have a talk about that. We can help each other out about that. I get to work with people who have those defects of character when I'm practicing my step 12, right? Those are the people who show up for me. I get the recidivists who are overly intellectual, educated beyond their intelligence. That's the guys that I got. They got all kinds of questions about what God is and why is it this way and why is it that way and why do I have to do this? And isn't it important that we discover all the reasons before you perform the heart surgery, doctor? That's the guys that I get, right? Because that's me. That's me. I need to know. I believe that I need to know. Well, you know what I've learned here is that I don't need an explanation. I need salvation. I'm going to die. That's the whole reason for it. I'm going to die. So I don't need to understand the subtleties. I need to throw myself on God's mercy, beg him to remove these defects of character so that they stop killing me. And maybe I can start to become of use to other people. You know, that's where the position that I need to take in this program and in this work. I did that. I made a list of the people. He told me, you know, out of your first column, out of your last column, out of your sex conduct, and say a little prayer and see if there's anybody else that belongs on that list. And there was a couple, you know. So he said, all right, you got it. Now go out and start making these things right. He gave me the formula for making amends. He said, you're going to make an appointment at their convenience. You're going to show up. You're going to introduce yourself as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're going to tell them what you think you did. And then you're going to ask them if they need to tell you anything about that, because maybe you don't know, right? Maybe I don't know what I did. Maybe I think I did this, but I actually did this, you know, I don't know. So I'm going to ask them to tell me what they need to tell me. And then I'm going to say, this is what I would like to do to try to make this right. This is my amend. Is there more that I could do? You know, so, and sometimes I don't know what that looks like. So I may be in the position of saying, I'm not sure how to make this right. What would make this right with you? You know, please tell me. And the most important direction after asking them questions both times is shut your mouth and listen. I don't get to have an opinion. I don't defend myself. I don't get to say, yeah, but you did this to me. That's not what we're talking about. I'm there to clean up my stuff. And so that's what I'm there to do. It's very important that I introduce myself as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because that might be the only time that somebody bumps into one of us. And what a great experience that will be. You know, I went and did some amends for shoplifting that I had done. And, you know, what do you think that guy was telling his wife about? And I'm in there saying, hey, I stole this from you. It was about this much money. I'd like to give you that money. Is there anything else I could do for you? Well, when was this? Well, like 15 years ago. You know, he's running a store. He's probably got stuff walking out the door every single day. Here's a guy who shows up 15 years later and says, hey, here's a $20 for this thing that I stole from you. Like, what do you think he's talking about? And what do you think he's thinking of when his sister or his cousin or his friend has a problem with alcohol? Well, I might be the only representative of Alcoholics Anonymous that ever showed up to his door. And so he may know where to go for help. That's why you do it. You know, you may not like it. It may hurt your pride. Oh my God, my pride, my poor pride. But my job is to be a maximum service to God and those about me. That's what I'm doing. After that, in that process, I'm doing this. I'm keeping in touch with him. I had an experience like I realized that I had forgotten to wake up every morning with a sense of impending doom. I hadn't been waking up with it. And then all of a sudden I realized that I wasn't. And I was like, oh my God, what's happened? I had forgotten to wait for the other shoe to drop. You know, I had forgotten. And so I called him and I said, I don't know what's going on. Something is like way out of whack here. I feel totally different. I've always had this like sense of everything being wrong. And now I don't know what's happened to that. And he goes, what the hell do you think we've been trying to do this whole time? He said, this is what we have been going for. This is what we have been driving at with all this work, is for you to have this rearrangement, to have this spiritual awakening, this transformation, this rearrangement of ideas. That's what we've been doing, you know? And he guided me into 10 and 11. He says, here's what you're going to do when you screw up during the day. That's what 10's about. Spot check inventory. He said, here's 11 at night. Here's the paragraph. Just read it and do it. And then when you wake up in the morning, here's the paragraph, read it and do it. And that's what you're going to do all the time. Now you're going to keep doing those spot check inventories. You're going to keep praying in the morning. You're going to do your review at night. That's your job. You can add other stuff into it. You can read books. I've developed a meditation practice, which has nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. I seek spiritual people. I love it. I love hearing a good talk. I used to be very anti-religious. Now I love it. I would go to anywhere and talk to anybody. I read all kinds of different books on religion and spirituality. I can't get enough of it. I think it's fantastic. And then the last part is he told me, okay, now it's time for you to do this with other people. And I thought, okay, I was scared. I thought, well, what am I going to say? What am I going to say to somebody? Like, won't I hurt them? Won't I screw them up? Aren't I going to, you know, like, wreck it. and you know, he said, well, you know, that's your ego talking, you know, that's fear talking, that, you know, somehow you are going to screw up an alcoholic even worse than he's been able to screw up his own life. Like, as if I could tell him anything that's going to make it worse for him. Like I said about the monkey, right? Like, the monkey's going to get it right half the time. You're not going to hurt them. Like, if you just, you know, what you're going to do is, you have an experience now, you have a big book, and you have me. And so I was going to, you know, he said, all you got to do is get together with these guys and take them through this work, take them through these steps. That's your job. And if they don't understand something, you're going to help them to understand it. And you're going to guide them, and you're going to, you know, maybe I'll have to push them along a little bit sometimes, but not too much. You know, he said, you're not going to chase after people. You're going to try to help them. You're going to offer your help. I'll give a guy a call a couple of times and say, hey, what's going on? And then after that, that's it. We're, you know, you're going to have to get back in touch with me now, and I'm going to go look for somebody else to help. And you know what? I was terrified the first time I offered to help a guy. And I was terrified the second time I offered, and the 10th time I offered to help a guy, you know, and the 20th time. I was still, even today, in talking to a new person, I still get a little bit of jitters. I still get a little bit of butterflies and think, oh, what am I going to say? As if that had anything to do with me, you know, as if that had anything to do with me. As soon as I get together with them, we start talking about this stuff, God shows up and I don't have to worry. God's got it. He's got me. He's got the new guy. Whatever needs to happen is going to happen. Whatever stories we're going to talk about, whatever parts of the book we're going to talk about, that's all inspired work. I don't have anything to do with that. I have total faith that God is going to show up. I believe he shows up right now when I do these talks. I don't prepare anything. I haven't got a clue what's going to cut him out of my mouth. I'm hearing this for the first time too, you know, and I have total faith that God is doing this for us. And so I've done that, and I have never... I've never wavered on working with people. I have never wavered on that once, because I believe that 10, 11, and 12 are not extra credit, as Charlie Parker says. It's not stuff that you do because you want to do a little more. It is part of the program. When I said, you know, if you have this problem as diagnosed in step one, we have a beautiful solution to that problem, which includes steps 10, 11, and 12. So prayer, meditation, and carrying this message. And for me, I believe that that means knee to knee with the new guy or the new gal, going through the steps, taking them through the steps. There's other forms of service. Absolutely, there is, that make 12-step work possible. And if you do that, God bless you, because I can't stand it. I'm a kitchen table AA guy. I love it. Sitting at a park bench, sitting at my table, sitting anywhere with a book open, talking to a new guy, taking him through the steps. That's my calling. I love it. But I believe that is the work. I believe that is the 12th step, that I must carry that message. This message, right? Not my message. This message. We have a set of steps. We have a language. We have a common experience. You know, it talks about that, that the cement and the powerful force that binds us is not, it's our experience combined with the common solution. So I think it's actually really important that we're on the same page, because my experience of God will be different than yours. My idea about God, my idea about power will be different than yours. The things that brought me here will be different than yours. I didn't go to jail. Maybe you did. I went bankrupt. Maybe you didn't. So our stories that got us here are going to be different. But the one thing that we can all agree on is on the way out and these steps. And it says at the beginning, there's a 50 to 75% recovery rate for people who came here and really tried, meaning they did these steps. That's pretty good numbers, man. When AA at large is like, I don't know, it's under 5 or 10%, whatever it is. But if you just show up here and you don't do the work, well, you know, we can't do anything about that. But if you show up here and you want to do this work, you want to take these steps, I'm going to take you through this book. I teach the guys that I work with to take people through the book in the same way. My sponsor does it that way. My buddies in AA do it that same way. We're trying to bring the book back into this thing, working with others, the importance of sponsorship, so that people don't have to roll around in AA for 3 years like I did, thinking, what the hell's wrong with me that I can't get sober? Well, there's nothing wrong with me. I just hadn't been presented the solution. So I want to make sure that it's out there for the new people coming in. I'll finish there. I think we wanted to leave a little bit of time. So thank you very much for listening.
Ah, thank you, Brian. That was amazing. I'm going to allow everyone to unmute. It looks like it sounds like your hiccups went away.
They did. Woo-hoo! God showed up and got rid of those too.
All right.
Just had to stop thinking about me for a minute, I guess.
All right. Looks like nobody's taking advantage of the unmute capability at this point.
Thank you very much, sir. That was fantastic. Thank you very much.
That was awesome.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Wonderful words.
You're welcome.
Thanks for sharing, Brian. I really appreciated it.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to take the meeting back. We'll give Brian a moment to exhale. The seven tradition states that I'll also remind everyone, if you have questions, send them in the chat to the user questions. Larry is taking them. We've got a couple in there, but we really want your questions. So the seven tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. I'd be happy to take just a few announcements for the good of AA. Anybody want to show their blue hand? Lisa B. You should be able to unmute now.
Okay. Hi, I'm Lisa. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Lisa.
Tonight at 10 o'clock on the late night, we're doing step work. Mr. David is speaking on step 12 and Miss Donna is speaking on step 11. If you guys care to join us and stay up late, it's going to be a really good meeting. I'll put the ID in the chat. If that's okay. And yeah, come join us tonight for late night. Thank you.
Thanks, Lisa. Chris D.
Hey guys, I just want to give a quick shout out to my home group, which is Living Sober on 49th Street. We're still meeting on Zoom, obviously, but we're doing it every Thursday evening at 5:30. So just want to give a shout out to that in case anybody's looking for a Living Sober meeting. Thanks,
Chris. All right, I will take Lisa, and then that's it.
Hey, everybody, Lisa Warsoff, alcoholic. I just wanted to let everybody know that Saturday morning brunch bunch this coming Saturday is having their anniversary Zoom meeting. We're going to have two speakers. It's at 9:30, and you can find the Zoom ID numbers and everything on the intergroup website. So, thank you.
Awesome. Thank you. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Sponsorship question. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will hang out after this meeting. Please feel free to stick around. You may have come in alone, but you do not have to leave that way. If you're shy, feel free to send an email to info@simpleactions.net. All right, so we're going to start asking questions. Please keep them coming. Brian, thank you so much. That was just clear and just wonderful. Thank you. When you say cabbie to me, I think that's a taxi cab driver. What is a cabbie? Yeah, well, maybe it's my deaf. It sounded like you got a cabbie to buy you four cases of beer.
Cab driver, yeah.
Oh, okay, all right, so it is a cab driver. So
yeah,
you, okay.
Yeah, yeah. In New Brunswick, they could do that.
Okay. I love the way you phrased it. I felt it was important to struggle. It was important to fight. Self-reliance. That was just a brilliant description. I think I just wanted to make that comment, but I don't know if there's any more in there to pick.
Yeah, no, that was it. I mean, I really did believe that, you know, I thought that was going to save me. I thought if I learned how to win the fight, I guess, right, versus just surrendering, that I would be able to win out, you know, and that's what had to go. Like, that thinking really had to go. It was keeping me sick, right? Because it's impossible, right? Quickly on that, following that was the intellectual side of it, like wanting the understanding, like wanting, well, why am I an alcoholic? And is it because of this? Is it because of my parents? Is it because of genetics? Is it because, you know, like, so why did I have to be an alcoholic? So, I wrestled with that stuff too. But that was with my sponsor, and he was, you know, pretty clear, like saying, hey, you know, that's not going to do you any good. The only value of my self-knowledge is to help somebody else. It's of no use to me whatsoever. Like, it's never helped me out, which is why I need a sponsor, right? Because I can ask him for advice that I would probably even give to somebody else, but somehow I have a blind spot when it comes to me that, oh, wait, what should I do about this thing that's happening? And he'll say, well, did you try this? And I'm like, no. So yeah, my knowledge doesn't help me out a lot, but it hopefully helps out, you know, the new guy, the somebody else can make use of that.
Thank you. When you talked about it, it was a wonderful description of how I feel when I'm not drinking, which is just so important to identification. And what was interesting is I've always liked the bedevilments that you described on page 52 and some of the other stuff I've always heard categorized as untreated alcoholism, but you continually use tied it to unmanageability. Is there a distinction there?
Not at all. No, that we also call it unmanageability, spiritual malady, untreated alcoholism, like all interchangeably, all described by those same, you know, 6863, page 52 in the middle. And then part of in the doctor's opinion as well, like where it talks about that, you know, the cycle where you take the couple of drinks and experience it, and then you go through the remorse and all that stuff again. Like, I think that's another good description of unmanageability and the action of getting back to the point where you need the relief again is sort of the unmanageability to me, or untreated alcoholism or spiritual malady.
Yeah. I think I like referring to it as unmanageability better. It ties right into the program. That's beautiful. What does faith mean to you, and how do you practice it?
Oh man, we had a great talk about this the other morning in our men's meeting. To me, it's about the disciplines of 10, 11, and 12, like, and particularly 10 and 11, that, like, my ideas about things are not always reliable, you know, like I can sort of hold one idea pretty strongly one week, and then the next week it's like totally changed into something else, or how I think I'm doing is generally not a very good indication of how I'm actually doing. Because I may think things are going really well, but I'm not, you know, like I'm not meditating. I haven't talked to a new guy. I haven't been to a meeting. Or I think things are going terribly, but I got a couple of new guys on the go and I am getting to meetings. So it's like my feeling isn't necessarily a good indication of that stuff. But I think that the following the disciplines is sort of how I practice faith most now. So, like, you know, really trying to attend to 10. And not waiting, you know, like not like in 10 and in the book, like in the chapter, like it actually describes a sequence of action that I'm supposed to take when these things crop up, you know, when resentment crops up, when fear crops up, when dishonesty crops up. Like, it tells me to ask God at once to remove it, to make an amend quickly if I've harmed anybody, to discuss it with someone else, and then to turn my mind to someone I can help. Like, I need to actually do that stuff, right? Like, it's not enough for me to do like what I call like a self-will check-in, you know, where it's like, oh, that No, I'm not resentful about that. I know better than to have a resentment, you know? So I like talk myself out of having the resentment, but what I'm actually supposed to do is ask God to remove it, talk to somebody else about it, make an amend if it's needed, and then look for somebody to help. And if I'm not doing that, then how faithful am I actually being? You know, like I'm not practicing this discipline. And if I'm not doing my review at night to say like, hey, did something happen today that I should have talked to somebody about? Did something happen today that I owe an amend for? You know, did I actually follow through on my 10 today is what 11 pretty clearly asked me to do. And then when I wake up in the morning, am I spending that time in prayer? Setting up for the day, you know, thinking about the day ahead, looking for, you know, am I worried about something? Am I asking God for a decision, for some guidance, for some direction? Am I opening myself to that power? If I'm not doing that, well, then how faithful am I being, you know? And it talks about later in that same part of the book about, you know, talking to priests or ministers. There's lots of helpful books. Like, am I seeking? Am I looking to broaden my experience around that power, around, you know, the idea of God or whatever it is for any of us. And am I working a 12 step? Am I consistently looking for new people to carry this message to? Am I practicing these principles in my affairs? And if I'm not, well, then how faithful am I really being? You know, because if I'm faithful intellectually, then I'm going to have an intellectual experience, but I don't need an intellectual experience. Like I said before, I need salvation. And salvation comes, I believe, through discipline and through continued work and continually going back to the power and continually going back to all of you, to the people around me. To, you know, what my grand sponsor used to say, the distance between me and you is the distance between me and God. And the distance between me and God is the distance between me and you. So it's all the same thing, you know. I have to constantly strive to deepen my relationship with Him and with all of you too, you know. And so I would say that's how I practice faith versus any kind of a organized. I've never like settled into an organized religion, but I have a very deep faith, a very strong belief, and I practice that through those disciplines.
Right on. You may have already answered this, but we have a question here. Would you be willing to share one of your experiences with 6 and 7?
With 6 and 7, absolutely. I a few years ago, I had a very different experience with, it came out of 5, because I used to feel, you know, when it says to take that hour, I used to feel like, man, what am I going to do for an hour? You know, like I looked over the first 5 proposals and, I have the memory of this inventory that I just did with my sponsor and okay, what am I going to do for the next, you know, 58 minutes? Like I didn't have a real connection to that. And then I heard, Mark Houston has, it's not a talk. I don't think you can find it anywhere, but he sponsored Charlie Parker and Charlie used to have a meeting, or I think he still does. He has a meeting at his house with all of his sponsees. And one day Mark showed up to that and they were talking about the 5th step. And Mark spent an hour talking about what to do in that hour. And man, did he ever put some clarity around the importance of recognizing the powerlessness, the unmanageability of your life through the lens of your inventory by seeing this stuff and thinking, you know, and this, especially with subsequent inventories, like, you know, out of your first one, you're probably just getting your socks knocked off by everything. So you might not have the same perspective, but if you're going back through inventory again and again and again, and sort of getting to this point, like, man, I did this again. You know, I lied again. I was dishonest again. On my own power, the best that I can do is to sometimes lie. The best that I can do is to sometimes be irresponsible. The best that I can do is to sometimes let people down. The best that I can do, you know, that. And so really getting in touch with that, you know, not only was this the best that I could do, it's the best that I could ever do on my own power. I will always behave that way on my own power. I will always run into those problems on my own power. And so when I roll into 6 and 7, after spending an hour really like feeling that stuff, I don't want to hurt people like that anymore. I don't want to be that guy anymore who gets into those complex situations, you know, and always people get hurt out of that. And you got to tap dance your way out of it, be it at work, or you got to go and eat crow, or you got to go and, you know, like, I don't want to be that guy anymore. And so coming out of 5, out of that hour, feeling the weight. When it says in the second step, and we agnostics crushed by a self-imposed crisis, we could no longer postpone or evade. That's what I think about when I'm coming out of that five, is I want to be crushed by that stuff, really feel the weight of living that way. Even though there's this power, I've turned my back on him again, and I've taken the, you know, I'm going to run these parts of my life. And then I'm going back to him again to say, I've done it again, you know? And so in 6 and 7, when I ask him, when I become willing, it's not like this intellectual, like, oh God, please take this stuff. It's like a desperate plea for God to remove the things from me, because I can't live with it anymore. I can't do this stuff anymore. I can't take it. I don't want to be like this anymore. And asking him to remove those things from me, you know, to remove them so that I can be of use to him and his fellows. And like I said, some things go, and some things have stayed. They keep me coming back to God. They keep me coming to be able to help other people. Specifically, I have no fear of financial insecurity. I don't. I have absolute faith that God will provide for me and my family whatever I need. And I don't have an attachment to what that looks like. If we're, you know, we have a pretty nice house. We live in a nice town. I have a good job. But I also believe if I didn't have that job, that God would provide for us what we needed, that he would provide. He always has. He always had. We've gone through, you know, lost jobs. We've gone through moves. We've gone through unexpected circumstances, and we've always had food. We've always had a place to live. We've always had, you know, enough. And so I believe that God will provide sufficiency to me. I believe that absolutely. So when there's ups and downs in the markets and jobs and even COVID, it's like, I don't worry about that. That has been absolutely removed from me. I continue to struggle with sex, with lust, with, you know, my relationship to sex is very painful to me. I can never find any comfort around it. I will go through periods of time where I have that, and I sort of feel like, okay, I think this is, and then I'll end up back in it again. And it's, you know, my head, and I've got all this like self-worth stuff tied into it. And I can't seem to get that one. That one hasn't been lifted. But like I said, I have had conversations with people that I couldn't have had, you know. I have friends who have lust has been removed from them, and they're terrible to talk to about that stuff, because they don't have a real connection to it. You know, you say, oh, I'm really struggling with it. And they're like, well, did you try not struggling with it? that doesn't do anything for me, you know? So it's, you know, but if I talk to somebody who has, you know, wreckage, who has inventory, who has amends around that stuff, we can have a real conversation about what that looks like. And then if we make progress, if we make, you know, if things change, then we can talk to each other, say, oh, you know, like my sponsor told me to really work on my sex conduct, like really, you know, to take a cue card and write some stuff down, but really pray on it. And, you know, he gave me some really specific direction around it. And I wrote that stuff down. And then he talked to me about how I needed to not just have it on a cue card, but I needed to work in my life. I needed to be obedient to that stuff that I put down. And if I wasn't, then I was going to continue to have these problems. And so it gave me this guidance, and it seemed to really make a difference, you know? And so I started to share that with some other friends that I knew struggled as well. And so like I said, he takes some of it, you get to keep some of it, but I think the real thing is to keep going back to him with it, you know, like if it's unclear how it's helpful, then to ask God, like, well, of what use is this, you know, pray for, to be shown what the usefulness is of these character defects that you may still have, you know. Like I got a buddy, he has a lot of anger issues, and he's got some long-term sobriety. Like he's really in this thing. He really lives this thing, and yet he can just go off sometimes, you know, and he prayed for that to be removed, prayed for it to be removed. And it was still there. And so he started to pray to God to show him how that was useful and how he could be of help to other people with it. And he saw what that was. He is not bothered at all to walk up to the guy at the back of the room who's gunning everybody off. You know, the guy, the biker guy or the tough guy at the back of the room, he's got his arms folded, you know, the leather jacket, whatever, beer, you know, whatever your tough guys look like, and just gunning everybody off, not wanting to talk about it. Well, he'll just walk right up to them. He doesn't care at all. He doesn't care about their anger. It doesn't mean anything to him. So he just went, hey, what's up? What are you doing? Let's go. Let's have a talk. You know, so he doesn't, So that's his usefulness, right? So he has that problem, but he can connect with those guys. He's telling me a story one night. He had this one guy, he got him out there walking along this pier, and the guy's just like losing. He's going on, rah, rah, rah. He shoved him into the water. He ran and just shoved him right off into the water, you know, like he didn't care. And, you know, the guy's all spluttering down there and he's laughing. And, you know, they worked it all out. But like you say, you don't know what that usefulness is going to be. So maybe try to be curious about it. Try to ask God to show you, to direct you how you might help others with it.
Awesome. So what paragraphs are you referencing that, let's see, I'm just going to read what's written. What paragraphs were you referencing that you go over before bed?
Oh, yeah.
Any more about steps 10 and 11?
Question. Yeah, so in, it's 70, no, I'm going to make a fool of myself here. I'm going to look it up. Yeah, so 84 has the directions for step 10, which is sort of down towards the bottom of the page, the bottom of the second full paragraph, you know, so it says this thought brings us to step 10. And then just partway down through that, it says, you know, it's not an overnight matter, should continue for a lifetime, continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, and all that. So that's where the specific direction is there. And then over on 86, the first full paragraph on that page says, when we retire at night. So that's the direction for when I go to bed at night. And then the next paragraph is on awakening. And that paragraph runs that page and then down to the bottom of the next page. So that's the stuff that I'm talking about, you know, like at this point, I remember it enough that I can do it. But if you don't, just read it, you know, just read it and do what it says to do. And then, you know, if you want to do anything else, do this first, because we know this works. If you have another faith, if you have a practice that goes along with that faith, like I said, I meditate, like I do, you know, like a Vipassana, like an Eastern Buddhist meditation. Well, I do this first, and then I do that meditation. You know, I got a buddy, he does these, this morning journaling. It's from the Artist's Way, morning pages. You write three, like, stream of consciousness pages every morning. And he swears by it. He's been doing it for a couple of years. He said the stuff that comes out of there is brilliant for him. It's really changed his life. But he does this first, and then he does that. So we know this works. So do this. And then if you want to add other stuff, readings, practice, do that too, but just do it afterwards, you know?
Yeah. In addition, not instead of.
In addition to, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Here's a tasty one. I have a question that says, do I really need to sponsor others to stay sober?
Absolutely.
Next question.
I mean, I can pull some stuff out of the book for that, but absolutely we do. It's not optional, right? Like try, that is the operative word. So if you talk to 10 people and none of them want you to be their sponsor, did you try? Yeah, you tried. It's between God and you and that other person, whether or not you're going to sponsor. But my experience is you keep trying, you're going to find people to work with. But the book says that, you know, nothing will ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail, you know. They give me the carrot and the stick in that chapter that, you know, and there's some, I don't know how many references it is to working with others in this book, but it's like, I think it's like 80 or so. Like there's a lot of references to working with others in this book. Like it's not an optional step. It is absolutely a necessity to do that work, to carry this message to the new alcoholic. And you want to, you know, this is the best part of my life is working with new people. Like, and I have a very full life. Like, I don't say that lightly. You know, I do have kids. I'm still with my wife. I have four children. I have a job. I have a full life. And yet that part of my life is so there. I mean, God shows up there, right? You sit down with that person, God shows up there. There's nothing like that. And I believe that I did the first 11 steps to be placed in the position where I could practice the 12th step, where I could be of use to somebody, where I can share my experience, where I could be armed with the facts about myself, and I could win the entire confidence of an alcoholic in such a short period of time. And it's amazing. You know, you sit down, you have a coffee, 2 minutes in, you know, 2 minutes in, you know, this is my guy, he gets it. And they feel that way too. You know, they feel that connection too. And then there's something that can happen there, you know, and it's not, I don't know if I'm going on too long in this one. I think it's so important. You know, we're not taking people on to raise. I'm not going to give you banking advice. I'm not going to give you career advice. I'm not going to give you relationship advice. My advice is going to be, this is how you do the steps. And if you call me up with a problem, I'm going to ask, did you pray on this? Did you go to God with this? Because I don't know anything about it. I don't know if you should take that, buy that business, or if you should leave your wife, or you should stay with your girlfriend. I haven't got a clue if you should do any of that kind of stuff. But I do know is you should be practicing these steps. And that's not that hard to do. You know, it's sort of intense at the beginning. It's, you know, the first couple of weeks, we're going to be getting together, you know, maybe a couple times a week. We're going to be hashing this stuff out. We're going to be talking about, you know, I'm going to try to help you to discover if you're an alcoholic by filling in any holes in the information that you've got. And when you read this book and you ask yourself if this is true of you and you want to know more about it, or if you're struggling with the idea of God or power, we can have a conversation about the difference between power and religion, or spirituality and religion. I'll have that conversation with you because that helped me. And you know, we'll talk about this stuff. And if you want to know like what goes in what columns, you want to make an appointment to do a fifth step with me, you want to get down on your knees and do the third step prayer with me, we'll do all that stuff. We'll knock it out in a couple of weeks. And then you're going to go out and make amends. You're going to start practicing 10, 11, and you're going to start helping new guys. And the only time you're going to call me is if you have a question because you don't know what to do with a sponsee you've got, or you want to tell me some good news, or you just want to see how it's going. Like, that's it. Like, I can sponsor an absolute ton of people because I am not going to manage your life. I'm going to get you through these steps as fast as you can go. And then you're going to turn around and start doing the same thing. So it taken from that point, it's not as daunting a task as I thought it was before. And I think a lot of people kind of hang on to the idea, well, what am I going to tell them? How am I going to run their life? It's like, no, you don't need to do that. You've got an experience. You've got a big book. You should have a sponsor. And that's all you're going to do is you're going to try and get them hooked up to the power in the same way somebody provided that opportunity to you.
Beautiful. Does your wife participate in Al-Anon?
She does not. She went to a few meetings. She decided it wasn't for her.
All right. Do you ever feel out of balance between AA, comma, work and family? Does your attention ever get pulled in one direction, causing you to neglect the others? If so, absolutely. How have you dealt with that?
Absolutely. It has been a point of contention between my wife and I. I have suffered in my career as a result of that. Not in the direct sense of like, hey, you didn't show up for work. Where were you? Oh, I went to an AA meeting. But more that I put my time into this versus developing my career further. You know, there's a lot more I could be doing to advance myself that I don't do, because I put my time into this, and that's fine with me. The place where I got to is I will pray. So it got to, you know, oh, I'm being asked to go, I got to go speak for so-and-so. Somebody asked me to go run a workshop. Oh, I got a sponsee calling me up. I got to do fifth step. Like there have been times there's been a lot coming at me. What I do now is I will pray when someone asks me, hey, can you do so-and-so? I'll pray on it. And whatever I get from that, I'll follow that. And yeah, you know what? Sometimes it does cause some problems either at home or should say with my wife, or my kids will be disappointed. But I do believe the guidance that I get. And then other times it's like, no, don't do that. And so I won't. I'll say, no, I can't make it for that one. And that seems to work pretty well. But yeah, definitely. I mean, that's been a really tough one, you know, like trying to work that out with my wife, because I went from being like very, arrogant about it. I think like spiritually arrogant, like, oh, well, it's AA, I got to do it. And this is, you know, God wants me to do this work, so I have to say yes, to taking a more, I guess like a more whole approach, right? Like I am a family man. I am a husband. I am a father. I am an employee. Like, so those are all parts of my life. And I don't believe that God wants me to do any one of those things to the exclusion of the other. He wants me to, you know, be helpful in all those areas. So I've had to learn about that through, you know, my wife getting really mad at me because I'm being really inconsiderate, and recognizing that, oh yeah, you know what? I actually am being really inconsiderate. Rather than that sort of spiritual arrogance, like, well, too bad if you're disappointed because I'm supposed to do this. That's not a very successful recipe for a marriage. So I would say I've learned it through just living through it, making mistakes, continually, you know, through the process of inventory, through 10-11 and praying, through talking to my sponsor. My sponsor is very even, like he's very much like, yeah, if you can do it and it makes sense, do it. You don't have, you know, don't say yes to everything because that doesn't make any sense at all. but I would say it's just been a very long learning process. And I keep going back to God with it to be like, hey, God, like, please guide me, please show me. And I get better at that. I get better at discernment as time passes too.
Right. Well, we have come to the end of our time. You've been very generous. I'm going to ask you one more question on the way out. Maybe you could do a minute or 90 seconds on what being a home group member has meant to you.
it's been very good. I have had commitments. My home group is currently shut down, but I have had commitments at my home group. I love my home group, show up early, you know, set up, help out, talking to people, looking for new people when, you know, once they start showing up. It's been a very powerful piece of my AA journey. You know, that's that whole circle triangle thing. One of those sides is being involved in the group and being responsible at the group, having a job, showing up. So I do feel that it's been instrumental in my being sober. So.
Thank you so much. That was absolutely amazing. I will unmute everyone after the Lord's Prayer. We can have the opportunity to thank Brian again. I'd like to thank everyone who participated, Larry for wrangling the questions, home group members, and all of you for showing up and giving a drunk like me a place to be. So the only other piece of business, and I haven't asked anybody, but maybe one of my homies would jump in and read the last, technically three paragraphs on 164.
My name is Leanne. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Leanne.
Let me close this. Okay. A vision for you. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thank you, Leanne. Thank everybody. So this concludes the meeting. Let's virtually circle up and virtually hold hands and actually say the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Woohoo! That was awesome.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. That was awesome.
Thank you so much.
That was fantastic.
Thanks, Brian.
And thank you, Simple
Action. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian. Glad you were here.
You're welcome. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks for speaking, man.
You're welcome.
Oh, that was delightful, Brian. Thank you so much. Really, just crystal clear, straight ahead. Beautiful.
Oh, glad.
Thank you ever so much. What a night.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Thank you so much. That was really good. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Lisa.
Is Lisa still here? I see there's a question that I didn't answer in the chat. happy to answer it if she's still.
Oh yeah, that was Lisa who was here. Thanking you.
Oh, hey. When I say I believe in power, what do I mean? Are you able to explain a little more? You know, that, like what I said is how it started. There's a line in the book that's we agnostic, you know, right after lack of power is our dilemma. This is a main object, you know, where are we going to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. And the problem not being alcoholism, but the problem being selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my problem. You know, this book will enable me to find that power. And the way that it enables me to find that power is by giving me a sequence of actions to follow, the end result of which will be this power, you know, making this connection with this power that will then solve my problem. I used to think that this was about sobriety, you know, that the whole point of this thing was, oh, you know, I need to get sober, that sobriety is the most important thing in my life. And I don't believe that's true. I believe the most important thing in my life is the power. And as a result of that connection, I stay sober. There's no part that I play in that beyond, you know, following what the steps tell me to do. You know, the problem is removed, it says, right, in the 10 step promises, that it describes a state that I get taken to through this work. So by, you know, by connecting to the power, what is it? I still don't really know. I've started calling it God in the last years. When I first got here, I was very clear not to call it that because I had a very big, you know, it says bristle with antagonism. I bristled big time. And so my idea of power was not that. Now I just say that because it's kind of like a shortcut, you know, it's like everybody sort of has an idea about that's power. And a lot of the readings and different places talk about God. And so I've stopped bristling, I guess. And I think about God, but I still don't really know what it is. You know, I was meditating this morning. I was listening to a Vipassana meditation and the guy was saying, you know, experience the truth of breath. You know, so breathing in and out. And I was like, maybe that's God. You know, maybe God is breathing me, and every breath that I'm taking is God coming into me and experiencing through me. You know, like so sometimes I think stuff like that, or you know, then I read Thomas Merton, and he's got a very different view of that stuff. Or read Anthony DeMello, or read I don't know. Like I would say, or, you know, I've done a lot of Native American stuff, you know, sat in sweat lodges and stuff like that. And I love that too. Any experience of, you know, some kind of larger, bigger than me, is to me is power and really, you know, getting out of the way. So I don't know. I don't think that's a very good answer maybe, but because I don't have a clear picture of what God is, you know, or what power is. I just know that if I do this, I seem to get taken to a place where I have a very different life and a very different view. And I don't believe it entirely comes from me. Like I think the part that comes from me is doing this stuff. And then the other part is this power that flows in undeniably, you know, to me, it's undeniable. But I still don't really know what it is exactly. It's amazing.
Yes,
it's brilliant. You know, it's just incredible.
No, you answered it very, very clearly. So thank you very much for answering my question.
Oh, you're welcome.
Well, and I related to just sort of that endless quest to intellectualize everything. You
oh,
know,
man,
I mean,
eh?
Because
terrible.
You know, because he lets us off the hook. He says it's impossible for any of us to understand or define this power. And I'm like, watch me.
Yeah. I've got 7 books I've written on this power.
Yeah. Are you challenging me?
Yeah. Oh, man, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, cool beans. Thank you very much, you guys. And I'll talk to you all later. Have a great night.
I'll see you in an hour and a half, Lisa.
Yes, sir. I can't wait.
All right. I'm going to jump off too. I got a buddy celebrating 10 years, so I'm going to go catch the end of his meeting. So thank you very much. Nice.
Thank
to
you, brother.
See you all.
Thank you so much.
Hey, we got Marty next week.
Oh, right on. I'll hop on. He's actually speaking at my buddy's thing that I'm about to jump on to.
Oh, right on. Okay. Yeah. Come back and heckle him.
I will. Good night, all.
All right. Good night.
Thanks, Brian.
Good night.